The Great Detective. William had recently seen a play performed by the Village Dramatic Society. It was a thriller and featured an adventuress, a corpse, and a murderer who wore evening dress at all hours of the day and lived in a large house amid tropical palms. But the Great Detective was the real hero. He appeared always in a dressing gown, smoking a pipe and working up clues with his hand on the collar of his amiable bloodhound. "There have been," said Mrs. Brown at breakfast, "a lot of burglaries around here lately." William stiffened. A little later he went out calling Jumble. He walked down the road, scowling at the houses as he went. In one of those larger houses, a criminal must live, somewhere where there were palm trees and a butler. Of course, a murderer was more exciting, but a burglar would do to begin on. He met a man coming up the road from the station, carrying a black bag. A bag! Of course, a burglar would need a bag. Somewhat startled by William's stern expression, the man turned round. William scowled still more. A guilty conscience. That was what made him turn round like that. He recognised, doubtless, the expression of a detective. Jumble barked excitedly and wagged his tail. Even Jumble suspected something. William turned and followed, creeping along in the shadow of the hedge. The man turned round again uneasily. William followed him till he saw him enter a pair of large gates by the roadside and go up to a fair-sized house with large bow windows. That night, William, after retiring for the night, dressed himself completely, donned a dressing gown in lieu of an overcoat, crept downstairs and out of the back door. He released Jumble on his way. Together they crept up the drive to the house. The bow window was open and the room was in darkness. The first thing William wanted to do was to find out what the inside of the house was like. If there were palms. He climbed in by the open window, holding Jumble tightly beneath his dressing gown. He went out of the room and across a hall, past the open doorway of a room in which the man who'd been carrying the bag was having dinner. Opposite him was, presumably, the adventuress, a little fatter than the adventuress in the play, and in a black evening dress instead of a red one. Still, you couldn't expect all adventuresses to look exactly the same. And she was wearing pearls. The pearls must be what the man had stolen last night and had been bringing home in his bag. William stood in the shadows for a minute, taking in the scene, then went down to a room at the end of the passage. A glass room. Palms! Ha! William had learnt all he wanted to know. He returned to the other room and out of the bow window. That evening, Mr. Croom, merchant in the city, turned to his wife with a worried frown.
"There's something worrying me, old girl," he said.
"What is it, Jim?" said Mrs. Croom.
"Well," said Mr. Croom, throwing away his cigar end, "have I seemed queer at all lately?"
"No," said his wife anxiously.
"Not as if I might be subject to hallucinations?"
"Oh, no, Jim."
"Well, it's a strange thing. I was coming along the road today, and I suddenly saw a boy. I hadn't noticed him before, and he seemed suddenly to appear. A most peculiar expression, very intense and searching, as if he had some message. You know, I'm never quite sure there's nothing in spiritualism. Well, I kept thinking about it as I changed. That peculiar, piercing expression, wondering, you know, whether it was hallucination or a message. There was something not ordinary about his expression, and, well, you may hardly believe me, but this evening, as we sat at dinner, I looked up and distinctly saw the same boy standing in the doorway and looking at me again with that peculiar expression. He wore a strange flowing garment this time. I pinched myself and looked round the room, and then again at the door, and, well, he disappeared, yet I swear I saw him with just that strange expression, looking at me, just for a minute.
Mrs. Croom, open-mouthed, laid aside her sewing.
"My dear Jim," she said, "I wonder
You might try psychoanalysis if the vision comes again. It's quite fashionable.
I hope, said Mr. Croom, that it won't appear again. It wasn't, on the whole, a pleasant expression.
Meanwhile, William, asleep in bed, was dreaming of Mr. and Mrs. Croom handcuffed.
It's chiefly jewellery that's been taken,
announced Mr. Brown from the local paper the next morning at breakfast.
Ha!
Said William sardonically. Mrs. Croom wants us to go to dinner on Saturday, said Mrs. Brown, looking up from a letter. Who's Mrs. Croom? Said Ethel. They're new people up Green Lane, the end house.
Ha! Snorted William. What's the matter with you? Said Robert.
You'd like to know, wouldn't you? Said William. Then he went up to his bedroom and, putting on his dressing gown, stood scowling into space with his elbow on the mantelpiece in the attitude of a great detective thinking out a clue. The bloodhound insisted on spoiling the picture by sitting up to beg. That evening, Mr. Croom looked very weary when he came home.
I went to a psychoanalyst, he said, about that boy, you know, and he asked me questions all about my past life. He asked me if I'd ever had a shock connected with boys, and I remembered that squib that a boy let off just in front of me last November. He says that this hallucination may be caused by a subconscious fear. He says that if, when I see the boy, I try to remember that really he doesn't exist, I may get over it. I met Cousin Agatha afterwards. She thinks it's a message. She wanted me to ask the Psychical Research Society to come down, but I think I'll wait until after the dinner party anyway.
Mrs. Croom clasped her hands.
Oh, Jim, she said. It's all very wonderful, isn't it?
William decided to bring off his great coup on the evening of the Croom's dinner party. He decided to go into the house and hide till the dinner had begun, and then go out and collect the stolen jewellery and convict the criminals. He expected vaguely to be summoned to Buckingham Palace to receive the VC after it. Anyway, his family would treat him a bit different. Just. Dusk was already falling when the great detective issued forth, a sinister figure with frown, lead pencil in his mouth for a pipe, and dressing gown on the track of the criminals. The villain's house was brightly lit up, and he experienced some difficulty in making his way in. He made it ultimately through the larder window. Then he gathered his dressing gown about him and reconnoitred. The coast seemed to be clear. He crept upstairs and then on all fours across the landing. A door opened suddenly, and the master of the house, in shirt sleeves, appeared full in William's way. William returned his gaze unflinchingly. The master of the house paled and retired precipitately to his bedroom.
I've seen it again, Murray, he said.
What, dear?
The subconscious fear, the message, you know. It was crawling along the passage outside in its curious long garment, and it gave me just the same kind of look, piercing, you know, almost hostile. I'm beginning to feel rather nervous, my dear. You've never seen anything of it, have you?
Never? Mr. Croom wiped the perspiration from his brow. Jim, you must go away for a change, said Mrs. Croom firmly, as soon as you can after the upset of this party's over.
Yes, yes. But supposing I see it there when I've gone away?
Well, I don't know, said Mrs. Croom vaguely. Perhaps they don't travel. Hallucinations, I mean. Meanwhile, the hallucination itself was concealed in the victim's dressing room. He waited till host and hostess had gone down. He heard the sound of effusively polite greetings downstairs.
How good of you to come.
Ha! Snorted William. Just you wait. Then he crept out and began to look around the room. He managed to find some of Mr. Croom's handkerchiefs. There was a horseshoe on one, probably the sign of a criminal gang. Then he went through the connecting door to the bedroom. He opened a drawer and saw a leather box. There was a key in it, but it was not locked. He opened it. Pearls, rubies, emeralds, all the stolen jewellery.
Ha!
Said William. He emptied it into the pocket of his dressing gown. He looked round the room again. There were some silver boxes and candlesticks.
William's stern frown deepened.
Ha! He said again. All stolen things. He put them also in his pockets.
The next thing was to try and find some handcuffs somewhere. You ought to have thought of that before. The party downstairs was going very well. The conversation turned on the thefts in the neighbourhood.
I hear that they've taken a considerable amount of jewellery, said Mrs. Brown.
Mrs. Croom paled.
Jewellery? She said. Oh, Jim, I believe I forgot to lock my jewel case. I believe I just left it in my drawer.
He rose.
I'll go and see, dear, he said.
He went out of the room. At the foot of the stairs was William, in a conspiratorial attitude, his pockets bulging.
White to the lips, Mr. Croom returned to the dining room.
I can't go just now, dear, he said to his wife.
Then he whispered with an air of mystery, It's there.
Someone gave a little scream. Oh, is the house haunted?
Well, admitted Mr. Croom, not without a certain wistful pride. It's not exactly the house. To be quite precise, it is I who am haunted.
The whole table was agog.
It's a boy, said Mr. Croom. I see him everywhere, in the road, in the house, with a piercing expression and curious raiment. He looks straight at me as if he meant something, a sort of freckled face, not friendly, I'm afraid. I've been psychoanalyzed. It's a sort of complex.
There was a hubbub of excitement.
Is it there now, outside the room?
Well, it was. But
may we go and see?
Yes, I should think so, but be careful. You know, those emanations can be very dangerous. A hostile aura, you know.
Three or four bold young men opened the door and crept cautiously into the hall. There was the sound of a scuffle and a high, indignant voice, familiar to two, at least, of the guests. The jaws of Mr. and Mrs. Brown dropped suddenly.
Let go of me! Take your old hands out of my pocket! Mind your own business! Well, I'm a detective, but I've not got any handcuffs. Leave go of me! I've left my bloodhound behind. That's not your stuff. Well, it isn't his'n. It's stole stuff. I've taken it because I'm a detective. Let go of me, I say. Leave go of my dressing gown, will you? I'll call the police. I say he's a robber, and I bet he's a murderer. Will you let go of me? He's a gang. Look at his handkerchiefs. Will you let go?
Still expostulating, William was dragged into the dining room. Mr. Croom covered his face with his hands.
That's it, he said. Don't bring it too near.
It's the thief, said the young man excitedly.
Look at his pocket full of things. Leave go of me, said William with rising irritability.
My jewels, screamed Mrs. Croom. Mrs. Brown, meeting her son face to face in such circumstances, did the only possible thing. She fainted dead away and did not recover till the crisis was partially over. William frenziedly accused Mr. Croom of theft and murder. He referred to handcuffs and bloodhounds. He said wildly that he'd had the house surrounded by police. It took about half an hour to convince him of his mistake.
Well, how do you know they're their own things? They only say so. I've seen him walk in suspicious with a bag full of something. Well, how do you know he isn't a gang?
William, pale and determined, in his dressing gown, gesticulated wildly with his hands full of jewellery. Mr. Croom was apologetic and pleading, wistfully grateful to William for being real. William, only gradually, and under the influence of a large and indigestible meal which Mr. Croom insisted on giving him in proof of his gratitude, forgot his grievances. Later, he found his father less sympathetic. Later still, he surveyed the world scornfully through his bedroom window and thought of his family.
It was no good trying to do anything with a family. The only thing was to cut loose from it altogether.
Mentally, he surveyed the past evening. Everything was different in real life. What was the good of being a detective when everybody said the people hadn't done the things? Real life was stupid. He decided to go on the stage. There, one could be a detective in comfort, and everyone didn't say the person hadn't done the things, and you'd made a mistake. Yes, he'd go on the stage. Feeling much comforted by this resolve, He got into bed and went to sleep.